Voyager Radio. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers, psychic phenomena and the unexplained, UFOs, extraterrestrial encounters, government cover-ups, alternative health care, new technologies. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager, and I have with me here today a very interesting gentleman. His name is Barry Bedell. Barry has offered to come in today to the show to talk a little bit about the book, Urantia. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Thank you, Bruce. Pleasure to be here.
What is your actual connection with this book?
Well, I'm not sure that connection is the word that I would use, but I am a long-term reader of the Urantia book, and also the publisher of the Concordex of the Urantia book, which is a combination index and concordance, the Urantia book being a 2,097 page volume.
All right, let's tell the listeners a little bit about this. First of all, Urantia is spelled U-R-A-N-T-I-A, and it's divided up into four parts. And part one is called the Central and Super Universes. Part two is the Local Universe. Part three is the History of Urantia. And part four is the Life and Teachings of Jesus. So this is why it's 2,097 pages long. That's a lot of information.
Yes, it is.
All right. Where did this book come from? Let's start right at the beginning, or at least what I presume the beginning is.
Okay, well, let me first, if I may, say what it purports to be.
Okay.
And I believe that it is.
Great.
It claims to be the fifth epochal revelation to our planet. The name of our planet on the celestial spheres being Urantia.
Okay, so this is not called Earth. I mean, we call it Earth.
We call it Earth.
It's actually called Urantia.
Urantia.
All right.
And it, as I say, claims to be the fifth epochal revelation.
Now, do I have to ask you what the first four were?
Well, I'd be glad to give you what they claim
are. Let's start with the first. Okay, with the first four. My goodness, it's already getting big. Okay, what is the first one? What is this called again?
The Urantia?
No, the epochal
revelation.
Epical revelation. All right. All right, let's start with those.
Let's start with the fourth one, if you would like, and then work backwards.
All right, the fourth epical revelation?
Jesus.
All right.
The third was Melchizedek.
Okay.
The second, Adam and Eve. And the first, Caligastia.
All right, now, where does all this information come from?
Well, in the table of contents, each of the chapters, which they call papers, has an author. And most of the authors, well, all of the papers, the author's name is given, and they are all various types of celestial beings.
All right. How did this thing get to Earth? Or, let's call it Earth for right now,
okay,
so that everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Well, strange as it may be, nobody seems to really know. There are a lot of mysteries in connection with how it did appear on Earth, and nobody really has the answer to that question.
Tell me what you think it is, or tell me what they say it is. What is the?
Well, I can tell you what is known.
All right, tell me what's known then.
The papers came through an anonymous individual during the 1920s and 1930s. They were initially read to a group of people studying psychology, religion, cosmology, philosophy, health, and over the course of time, these papers were read aloud to this group of people, and ultimately they were finished. And they were studied for a number of years, and in 1955, They were published by a nonprofit foundation in Chicago called the Urantia Foundation.
Okay, let's stop there. Did this anonymous person go someplace to learn this? Or did this person channel it? Or how did this person get this information?
Well, as I say, nobody really knows how exactly it happened. And ostensibly, it happened in a way that nothing else has. One thing we do know is that the individual was anonymous. Another thing we know is that he was completely disinterested in the phenomena that he was going through, and that he was not predisposed to lead a lifestyle or to personally believe in manifest the teachings in his own life.
Okay. This is not a religion, or is a religion?
Absolutely is not a religion per se.
It's a history.
Well, it's a religious revelation, and it's here to leaven all religions. All religions have a great deal of truth and goodness to them, and the Urantia book is here to leaven and to help build on the good things that are present in all great religions.
In today's understanding of this kind of stuff, would we probably say that this anonymous person channeled extraterrestrial information? Would that be...
Well, I'm always a little uncomfortable with the term channeling. It means different things to different people. And I think that there was no, as far as I know, no dialogue between this person and the other beings, nor did this individual call upon them to produce or to be interviewed at a particular time.
Oh, I see.
These things came in their own good, sweet time, and this person was simply a disinterested conduit rather than a participant.
Right. A vehicle, a conduit, a unit, whatever he was.
Yeah.
And we know it was a he. We don't know if this was a she.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
I've heard it referred to as he. It could have been a she just as well.
So somewhere between 1920 and 1955, these papers were assembled. They were received. Now, were they edited?
No.
Okay, no. They weren't edited.
They purportedly are in print, word for word, as received, with no human coloration.
All right, so we've got this. This is the fifth epical revelation. Does that mean, am I inferring that there are four other books the size of this?
No, the other revelations were not in book form. For instance, Jesus, being the fourth, was here through living a life.
Okay.
And this is my own belief only, but that this fifth one came at a time when most people can read. And can therefore have access to it. And by having it in writing, it is not subject to interpretations.
Sure.
And there is not a great deal lost as one tells another and tells another and tells another and so forth.
Well, let's start with part one and talk a little bit about the central and super universes. Why don't you just give us a rough idea as to what some of the things that are covered. My goodness, as you said before, roughly 2,100 pages of information. We can't possibly cover very much of it, but let's get an idea.
Okay. First of all, I would like to say that while the cosmology, the hierarchies of individuals are all very interesting reading, to me, the most important thing is the clarification of who God is and the nature and the attributes of God and the relationship that is possible for every individual to have with the Universal Father, the all-powerful creator of everything. That, to me, is probably the most important thing about the Urantia book. Going into the cosmology very superficially, It depicts in enormous detail what all is out there in creation. We look up on a beautiful starry evening and see untold numbers of stars, and yet what we see is only a fraction of all that is out there. The Urantia book tells us, for example, that there are over 7 trillion inhabitable planets.
Now that's an important concept, just to stop for a moment. Inhabitable doesn't mean that they're necessarily being inhabited now, but that they, if there are 7 trillion, we could assume that if half of them are inhabited now and half of them either were or will be inhabited, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of inhabitants.
Yeah, I doubt if half of them are now, but nevertheless, there are billions of them, I think, that are inhabited now.
Yeah, if 1 millionth of them,
yeah,
that's still a lot.
And just to get a handle on how vast all of this is, the Urantia book says that we live in the 7th super universe. And there are...
So there are 7, or that, or we're in
seven,
the 7th?
There are 7 super universes.
All right. So there's a finite number. Nice to have some finite numbers for a change.
Yeah. And it goes on to say that even beyond all that we see and a lot of what we can't see, there are 70,000 new universes in the process of being formed, each one of them bigger than all of the existing visible creation. So there's a lot of real estate out there. There's no shortage of real estate. And the interesting thing is that hardly a month goes by but that we don't read in our magazines and newspapers about astronomers have discovered huge new galaxies out on the apparently the far fringes of creation. And I suspect that the new Hubble telescope, when it's fully operational, will give us just an incredibly marvelous picture of creations as yet undreamed of.
Just to come back down into our own immediate universe for a moment, we're using the term universe now. We're not talking about solar systems. We're not talking about galaxies. We're talking about universes. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is just for the listeners and for me to clarify this. We have never seen beyond our own universe.
Well, I am not an astrologer.
Well, I don't remember astronomers ever saying anything about seeing beyond our own universe. They may have speculated that it's a curved universe or that there may be other universes, but I don't remember ever reading anything like that.
I think actually from reading the Urantia book that some of what we see way out there is beyond our universe and in another universe, perhaps.
Okay. All right, so perhaps we have not learned what the boundaries of universes are.
Right.
Okay. So, we are in the 7th
super universe.
A super universe contains other universes?
Well, it contains a lot of local universes. And we live in a local universe that is part of a super universe.
All right, so we're in a local universe. Does that have a name?
The super universe is Orvontan, and the local universe in which we live is Nebadon.
Okay, I don't think that anyone's going to.
Nobody's going to. Nobody's.
Unless you're taking notes out there. Great, great, I love it. Okay. Central and super universes. How about just a little bit more about this, and then we can go perhaps on to the local universe. But let's just stick with this for a moment. How much of the Urantia book is devoted, for the listeners out there, just to this first part, which is specifically about these...
Well, maybe a quarter of it at the most.
So
but,
almost
well,
500
it,
pages.
It's instead of... a lot of figures and things like this, a great deal of that has to do with the nature of God and the other celestial personalities that assist him in running this vast creation. So it's extremely interesting. And it also begins early on to talk about how we as mere mortals, and insignificant as we may seem to be, actually are extremely important in the eyes of God, and how he wants each and every human being to have a personal relationship with him. So it's really not simply a description of large space bodies and highly technical information, although there's certainly a lot of that, but it's also a very moving spiritual content in that first section.
We've got quite a hierarchy here.
Well, when you stop to think, you can't run a city government without officials.
Right.
You can't run a major corporation without all kinds of executives and assistants and managers and workers. Certainly it makes sense to me that it'd be difficult to run entire creation without a lot of helpers.
All right. We've got a big, enormous hierarchy here. And yet God says that we can have a personal relationship with him. I like that. That shows his incredible power and strength, and just the way we've always agreed that it would perhaps be. And yet on the other side of it, we see that there's this large, large group of helpers, which also makes a lot of sense. Why don't we move into the local universe and see what we've got here? That's part two. And that's the story of our part of the galaxy, is that correct?
Of our part of the universe, that's right.
What do we learn in the book there? What are some of the important things to know about the local universe?
Well, the local universe's
name is this Nebadon?
Nebadon.
All right, Nebadon.
Mm-hmm. We learn about the personalities that rule the local universe. Perhaps as interesting or more interesting, we learn about how we will ultimately, upon cessation of life here, begin the endless adventure of experience and learning as we progress towards ultimately reaching paradise, maybe billions of years from now. And we read that the local universe really is like a vast university, and we are going to be privileged to matriculate, that's a tough one for me, in the next phase of our existence, and gradually learn a great deal and gradually perfect ourselves.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these personalities you've been mentioning. Let's get some names. Who comes up here?
The most important name I think is Michael of Nebadon.
This is the Archangel Michael that we're talking about.
Well, he's not really an archangel. Michael of Nebadon, according to the Urantia book, along with his consort, the universe mother spirit, are actually the creators of this local universe. And
so they work as direct representatives of God, in the sense that they have an area that they develop, much like developers
exactly.
might go out and locate a territory and begin to develop it.
Precisely. Good analogy.
All right. So there's Michael, and his female counterpart doesn't have a name, or does have
Well, it's the mother spirit.
The mother spirit.
And Michael is known on this world, on Urantia, as Jesus of Nazareth.
All right, so we find then that when Michael incarnates, the last time we've seen him, he called himself Jesus.
That's right. That was
He been here in other?
No, he hasn't. That was his seventh incarnation. And what it really does is it makes the Jesus of Christianity even larger in his importance and so on than we tend to gather from reading the Bible.
Right.
Because he is actually the creator of all of this.
So when he says, "I and my Father are one," is he referring to himself as being not only the Son, the incarnation being the Son, but actually having been the Father or the Creator?
No, I think he means that he is acting in complete accordance with the universal Father's will when he says that.
Okay, so we have part three, which is the history of Urantia. Let's talk a little bit about how this immediate history then we're going to look at got going. Urantia, I guess, according to the book, has had some problems. It's not like a lot of other worlds, and maybe you could expound as to why it's not like many of the other worlds.
Well, it's certainly apparent just by looking around that we do have problems here.
All right.
But I think the outcome, the ultimate outcome, is it will be very, I'm very optimistic about that. There are a couple of reasons, several reasons, why we do have perhaps more problems than another inhabited world would have. One of them has to do with the Lucifer Rebellion.
All right, so we've got the name Lucifer. Now, we've all heard Lucifer before. Who was Lucifer? What was... And we heard, in the Bible, it says Lucifer was working in accordance with the laws of nature. He was working with God, and then somewhere along the line, we see that Lucifer has been cast out.
That's right. Lucifer was a brilliant sovereign of the local system. And he... decided that things were not progressing as swiftly as he thought they should have been, and instigated a rebellion against the rule of God.
Now he had helpers?
And he did have helpers. Another one that we have heard of is called Satan.
All right, so
Satan was his lieutenant.
Ah.
And together they enticed a great many other beings, angels, and so on, to join them in this rebellion. As a consequence of this...
Well, now they also got Caligastia, right?
Yes, Caligastia was the planetary prince of Urantia, and he also joined up with them.
And so now, in other words... Up until this moment, I think a lot of us thought that Lucifer, Satan, Caligastia were names for the same entity.
Not at all. They're three distinct, totally different individuals.
But they definitely all three represent a concept which is to go against the wishes of God.
Of darkness.
Right.
Correct.
So Caligastia would be the prince of darkness at this point.
Right. He is also the one that many here refer to as the devil.
Okay. So Caligastia exists. I should remember this now.
Yeah, he does. But according to the Urantia book, he's incarcerated.
Okay.
And is no longer free to wreak mischief. Against anybody's will. But as a result of this rebellion, our planet was in effect quarantined. Normally, a planet at this stage of development would be in regular contact over the spiritual circuits with other planets like ourselves and with the more advanced planets. So
this is why we think we're alone.
In effect, we are.
We are alone. The reason that nobody's contacting us, nobody comes down and says, "Hey, guys, how you doing? How have you been in all this?"
Well,
it's not because...
We're not forgotten, however.
Well, no, we're not. We're not contacted. We're quarantined. Quarantined is a good word.
That's what they call it.
That means that they know we exist.
The circuits are not open. They are well aware of what's going on here. And in fact, we have student visitors from other planets come to observe life as it is lived on a rebellion-torn planet. And most significantly, every normal human being on this world has a direct connection with God through the indwelling spirit that has been bestowed on all human beings.
Is there a name for that?
Well, yes. You know, in the Bible, Jesus is quoted as saying the kingdom of heaven is within. And I believe in some of the Eastern religions, they have, I think it's called the Atman, the indwelling spirit. And in the Urantia book, they use that name, the pilot light, the inner spirit. But most often, they refer to it as a thought adjuster.
Which sounds like something from science fiction.
Well,
is this something that actually changes your thoughts, or
it doesn't do anything against our will, but its purpose is to help us to yearn to be more perfect and more godlike.
Our conscience?
Well, it's not a conscience either. It's conscience is more reactionary, I think. But this is actually like a gentle guide. That,
it's not like Jiminy Cricket, that guiding
Pinocchio. No, I wouldn't say that. But it is here to help us to develop our souls so that we are worthy of survival.
All right, so we've got Lucifer, Satan, Caligastia. Caligastia was the prince of Urantia. But Satan and Lucifer were actually had other people under them. So
they were much higher up. There are other planets in the same fix.
So in other words, I'm just going to ask you. Are there other books like this out then?
Well, there may be on other planets.
Okay,
I don't know.
Other planets have other names, and they probably have books too that explain the predicament that they're in.
At the time that the higher ups felt, or if they feel that the time is ripe and the people will be receptive, then they would in some way or another receive a book or some other kind of spiritual revelation.
What about Adam and Eve? What part do Adam and Eve play in a lot of this? I mean, how did... According to a Urantia, the Urantia book, how did all of this stuff get going then? I mean, is it a lot different from the Bible, or
is the Bible
more like a Reader's Digest condensed version of?
No, just as much of, and I can't speak with authority on the Bible. I'm not really a knowledgeable Bible student, but the Old Testament incorporates the best teachings of the ancient prophets. The New Testament expands and clarifies some of the things in the Old Testament, and God becomes more loving as the writers of the New Testament had a greater understanding of how loving he truly is. And the Urantia book incorporates much of the great truths of the Bible, but doesn't hesitate to present a different story when it feels that is necessary.
All right, let's go right to it. Give me a couple different stories.
Well, Adam and Eve, you asked about that. And yes, Adam and Eve were high beings that lived here, but they were not the founders of the human race. They were not the first humans. They were, in fact, the second epical revelation, and they came here to basically upstep and accelerate the progress of the various races to make them more spiritual,
so
to make them more disease resistant,
right,
to help foster a more advanced type of human being.
So were they genetically changing everything then?
They were intended to have children, and gradually, through the infusion of this Adamic blood, upstep in combination with advanced teaching, the Garden of Eden, and so on. But unfortunately, they did default.
Sitting in my lap, a book that weighs about 10 pounds. Have you ever weighed this book, Barry?
Well, I think it probably is closer to seven.
Seven pounds.
It is a load.
Barry Bedell, here on the Timeless Voyager Show, discussing the Urantia book. And we're going to go to part four and talk a little bit about the life and teachings of Jesus according to the Urantia book. Why don't you open that up?
When you got the book or first saw it, you thought, I don't want to have to know all of this. And it isn't important or necessary for anybody to know all of this. The only thing that really is important is to know that they are, every individual is a child of a loving God. And if you have faith in that, that's sufficient.
I like that. So that means that we can go through our lives without reading the Urantia book.
You can. Most people do.
Right. But if you so choose to know the details, here it is.
Yeah, and many people that do take the time to check it out and explore it find that as they get into it and go through it, why, if they had no other way to obtain one, they would probably scrap all of their other books if they had to, in order to just have the Urantia book, because it does grow on you as you delve into it.
Okay, let's talk about Jesus. First of all, we mentioned before that Michael of Nebadon incarnated as Jesus in his seventh incarnation. What was his sixth incarnation? Do we need to know that?
It talks about it in the book, but for our purposes,
okay,
we don't. There's more things that are more really relevant to our lives today than...
Okay. So, let's pick up on that. Michael incarnates as Jesus of Nazareth.
Yes, he was, as it says in the Bible, he was born in Nazareth.
It does say in the Bible he was born of a virgin, though.
No, the Urantia book says he was born a woman just like every other babe.
All right. So there's a definite difference.
There is a difference.
That, of course, doesn't mean that Mary wasn't any more evolved or less evolved just because she wasn't a virgin.
No. Most mothers are not virgins.
All right. So we're not lessening the importance of Mary, but just making a statement here.
No. Actually, the Urantia book describes the times of the bestowal, how the family, Joseph and Mary, were selected, and they were thought to be the ideal couple to be the parents of the earth presence of this of Jesus's bestowal. They were not super beings in any way, not to be glorified in any way, but simply upstanding people and good parents.
Now the book actually talks about the time that Jesus was born, the day. Do you have some of that information at this moment, off the top of your head?
Well, yes. Actually, he was born on August 21st, 7 A.D., which, interestingly, now in the newspapers around Christmas time every year, there are articles about how the astronomers, through the use of computers and checking astronomical events and so on, have pretty well come to the conclusion that actually he was born back about 7 years B.C. and generally thought to be in the autumn. The Urantia book sets it as August 21st. That's really not important.
Well, I mean, it's important in one aspect. I mean, there's a whole group of people out there that would swear that Jesus was born on the 25th of December, which...
Well, that's fine, well, I mean, and it's a wonderful...
But if we're going to be accurate, if we're going to say that he was born a particular time, let's see if we can really find out. All right, he has a family. Did he have brothers and sisters?
Yes, he did. He had several brothers and sisters, and that is one of the things that makes the Urantia book's tale of his life and teachings so unique. The Bible has a great deal about the glorified, the crucified, and risen Jesus.
And also through the eyes of Paul.
And largely through the eyes of Paul. But Jesus came to teach us, but also not only in the words that he said, but through the life that he led. And because of the death of his father when Jesus was 14 and being the firstborn, he had to assume the responsibilities for a large household. So he, in effect, was both father and brother to a large family.
Okay, was his father really a carpenter?
He was a carpenter and a contractor.
Oh, so he was a contractor. Was his name really Joseph?
Yeah.
All right, so at least we got that.
Yeah.
So, but you know, that's an interesting point, because in the Bible, all of a sudden, Joseph and Mary are out of the picture. We don't hear anything about them. Here we find out that Joseph died when Jesus was 14, and then Jesus took over. Was he the oldest?
He was the firstborn, yes.
Oh, he was the firstborn.
Oh, yes.
All right. He took over his father's business.
He took over that, not contracting, but working in the wood shop,
uh-huh.
And had the formidable challenge of economically supporting and the emotional responsibilities of raising this family.
I notice in the this part four, there's a year-by-year description of how Jesus grew, what he did, where he studied, who he associated with, etc.
That's right.
We're missing all of this in the Bible. We have basically he was 12 and then he was 32.
Yeah, the New Testament largely is the tale of several very significant events reported by various apostles.
Right. Namely Matthew, Mark,
Luke and John.
John, right. And Paul, certainly.
And Paul wasn't an apostle, but Paul was a great believer when he became converted, and certainly was the instrumental figure in the early spread of Christianity. But you might say that the New Testament is largely a religion about Jesus, whereas the Urantia book really presents the religion of Jesus.
Hmm. All right, so we go along.
Which incidentally tends to be unifying,
right,
and not at all divisive.
Right.
And it's interesting because I have, amongst people that I have known, some people that somewhere along the line got turned off to Jesus. They just couldn't go for him the way he was popularly presented. Upon reading about him in the Urantia book, came to an understanding and a great love for him. On the other hand, some people that loved Jesus but wanted to know more about him have found that the Urantia book makes him ever so much more real and so much more believable and so much easier to relate to and with.
It even talks about the 12 apostles. I mean, we learn all these things, like James and Judas.
Yes, it talks about the apostles, gives a remarkable understanding of them. And I think one of the really encouraging things is that when you read about each of them, you realize that they were just ordinary men. And they had all of the foibles, all of the temptations, all of the inadequacies that we have. They were just basically ordinary men. And yet, through being with Jesus for just, I guess, 4 years, they transformed their own lives and went out and literally turned Western civilization upside down.
It says here that he had intensive training for his apostles. They actually spent a great deal of time. I want to read something here for those of you taking notes, page 1543. It says, Jesus endeavored to make clear to his apostles the difference between his teaching and his life among them and the teachings which might subsequently spring up about him. Said Jesus, My kingdom and the gospel related thereto shall be the burden of your message. Be not sidetracked into preaching about me and about my teachings. It sounds to me like they didn't listen, or someone wasn't listening.
Well, that's human nature, I guess.
It goes into taking some of the most famous quotes that we've certainly heard about and giving them and talking about them, different prayers. But it does definitely go into the a little bit about the different crises that we all know about.
Yes.
Does it discuss the crucifixion?
Very much so. Yes, it does.
And does it give any information about what the crucifixion is about and why there was a resurrection, or if there was one?
Yes. It says that obviously Jesus had to leave this earth in some way, and he believed it was his heavenly Father's will not to interfere with the normal course of events, whereupon a very evil group of men had him arrested and crucified. The crucifixion, however, was not part of a divinely inspired plan. He did not die as a human sacrifice to appease an angry and wrathful God, nor to buy salvation for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that he refused to interfere with the outworking of things as they were going along.
What was the purpose of the resurrection?
Well,
was that to show everyone his strength and power?
Well, I think it wasn't that. It was that his life was finished here, and he was then made ready to return to the Father.
Why not come back like the rest of us?
Well,
we're all resurrected.
Once that we die on this earth, we will not appear again on the earth as he did in various forms subsequent to the resurrection. But our souls will in time be reconstituted on a mansion world.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we will be not physically in the flesh and bones resurrected, but we will live again.
Well, we've talked about just a tiny bit of the Urantia book. Let me ask you about the Maurantia life. What is that? What is that about?
Okay. Before I do that, I'd like to say one more thing about Jesus. We all want peace in the world, and I think that if we really understand what Jesus taught, that we are all children of a loving parent, that makes us, frightening as it may seem at times, brothers and sisters. And if we recognize that we are all one human family, and that every one of our neighbors has this indwelling bit of God, then we can begin to treat each other with the love and the respect that is absolutely essential for peace to prevail in the world.
All right.
But the mansion worlds, you say?
Okay.
Okay, well,
the Maurantia life.
The Maurantia life. They refer to Maurantia as that state between the physical and the purely spiritual.
Okay.
And just like a child who gets out of kindergarten is not ready to go for a graduate degree at Harvard, once we get out of this first life, we are hardly prepared to go to paradise or some boring place where the streets are paved in gold and there are a lot of angels in white smocks playing harps. But we are ready to take the next step, just like a child going from kindergarten to first grade to second grade to third grade. And we begin that on the mansion worlds in the Maurantia form, that is, in between physical and spiritual.
The midway creatures. What are they?
Midway creatures are really the permanent inhabitants of Urantia. We are merely the transients. It's their world. And believe me, while we rightfully have a vested interest in protecting the planet and in cleaning up our environment, think how important it is to the Midwayers, who are the permanent inhabitants here.
So of all of this, here's the biggest shocker of all. This isn't our place in the first place.
Not at all.
So do we
live here maybe 70, 80, 90, 100 years.
Now, what are the Midway creatures? Do we see them or can we not see them? Or?
We ordinarily cannot see them.
So they are out of the...
Just out of the field of vision.
So the Midway creatures, this is their planet.
They are the inhabitants here, right. Ultimately, when the planet is someday settled in light and life, they will have a chance to move on to the advanced worlds also. But for now, they are here indefinitely.
Okay.
And what are they for, I suppose you're
all right,
you're
yeah, let's go through. What are they
well,
for?
Well, like all...
Are they for anything? I mean, after all, this has to do with reasoning mind. I didn't know if that was an appropriate question.
Sure, they are here to assist the angels and other spiritual beings in the running of the planet.
Okay.
And in even in some cases helping human beings.
Are they guides?
In effect, you might call them guides.
Okay, how about the ghost cults? What are ghost cults about?
Oh boy, I think that's going a way back to more primitive times when groups of people, fearful people, believed in nasty ghosts.
Okay, and so you're saying that that's not relevant now, or?
Right.
Okay. All right, well, Barry, we've just about run out of time. I wanted to mention to those of you who have been listening, I've been speaking with Barry Bedell. We've been talking about the Urantia book. The book is published by the Urantia Foundation. It's local, it's locatable. That's a weird word.
Obtainable.
I'm losing my vocabulary after going, I'm just asking about the ghost call. It's the Midway creatures that shocked me.
They're all loving. There are no hostile personalities outside of other human beings in this life that we have to be concerned about.
But you can find this book in almost any bookstore. And then you publish a Concordex. And that can be found in most bookstores.
Can be found or ordered
right
through bookstores, and they're also available in libraries. People like to check it out there first.
Barry, I want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for coming on the Timeless Voyager show. I really do look forward to having you back on again. I think that now that we've covered some bases here, maybe we could really get into some interesting stuff. There's a lot in this book. And for those of you who are going to have to read it to find out what happened with Adam and Eve, I think we'll get Barry on the next time, and we won't let him off till we find out over the air. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Barry.
My pleasure, Bruce.
This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager.